She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, and I hope you heard that. We don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Thanks for joining us today. We greatly appreciate our sponsors, and a special thanks today to the sponsor of this show, Chapman Tucson. In case you don't know it, Chapman showcases many of the top 10 award-winning cars for fuel efficiency. They have a green team that's committed to sustainability from the inside out. Chapman, thanks for all you do, and thanks for your support. We have a very important and very exciting show lined up for today. It's my pleasure to welcome Larry Schweiger, the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. Since Larry's return to the Wildlife Federation in 2004, his commitment has been to confront the climate crisis and to protect wildlife for our children's future. What a noble intention. The National Wildlife Federation is one of America's most effective conservation organizations, with 47 affiliates and more than 4 million members and supporters. Larry has made climate change a top Federation priority. He's written a book on global warming and wildlife, Last Chance, Preserving Life on Earth, which was awarded first prize for nonfiction by the Next Generation Indie Book Awards in 2011. Welcome, Larry. It is really great to have you here.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with you this morning.
We have really lots to talk about, and I think it's always great. Every once in a while I say, you know, let's start at the very beginning, a very good place to start, because I think that the Federation has a very interesting history, starting with founder Ding Darling's vision to forge a different kind of what I would call marriage between the General Wildlife Federation, I believe, that was later changed.
Yes.
And then
yep.
working and uniting sportsmen and all outdoor and wildlife enthusiasts to help build this common goal. So can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, Ding Darling had been watching as a cartoonist the inadequate response to the threats of his day. I mean, this was back in the 30s with the Dust Bowl and all the other threats to nature. He saw the decline in wildlife species across the board. Ducks were at an all-time low. Just the entire landscape was changing in a very dramatic way, and there wasn't an adequate response from people who were concerned. And Darling, in his first speech, said that 1,000 stallions unconnected cannot move a baby carriage.
Oh my gosh.
And he was really calling out the fact that we have a dispersed group of interests that are not working together in a cohesive way to get things done. And so he set out to create the National Wildlife Federation, actually convinced the President of the United States, FDR, to call the first National Wildlife Conference, and it was held at the Mayflower Hotel in 1936. And it became the moment for the ingathering of a lot of concerned groups across the country to work together to tackle some of the great problems of the day.
And, you know, when I say that, and I really do believe this, I say it sincerely, that you are a visionary because of what you have chosen to focus on and the direction in which you're taking the Federation. Ding Darling was really a visionary because he didn't have all the science behind what we know is happening. He didn't have the population. So talk about a thought leader and a visionary. I think he would be quite sad about the lack of progress, perhaps, that we are facing today.
You know, Darling was indeed a visionary. In fact, there's a great video, a great film out called Ding, America's Darling, and it really captures some of what you just said. Darling saw things long before others did, and he really try to bring people along in that process and spend his whole life really doing that. In his cartoons, for example, in 1949, did a cartoon pointing to an energy crisis that was going to hit us in the 70s. But he saw it already in the late 40s.
It's unreal.
And yeah, it is. It's just the way he looked at his world. He's a futurist by orientation and a great cartoonist on top of all that.
In terms of if he was here sitting on this interview with us, how do you think he would assess the success of the marriage of the opposing factions with what are now called environmentalists or conservationists and, you know, some of the sportsmen, and there's issues around the wolves and encroachment. We have an issue here with our goats. We have the mountain goats that are killing the bighorn sheep that are killing the mountain lions. So there's having a fit about that. So what would Ding Darling say about how are we doing in terms of the factions working together for the greater good?
Well, I don't want to try to channel Ding Darling, but I would say this about
that'd be kind of fun, a different kind of show,
yeah,
though.
but I would say, based on everything I know about Ding, and I know several of his family members and have talked to them about this as well. But Ding believed that we needed to be working together. He believed that it was a matter of not necessarily agreeing on everything, but finding a way to work together in a collaborative way. In fact, he was frustrated with the National Wildlife Federation after he finished his term as president, and because the federation had drifted more towards the hunting and fishing position. And it wasn't until the early 60s when Tom Kimball came to the federation and really rekindled the original Ding Darling vision of marrying the two interests that Darling came back to the Federation. In fact, he wrote a beautiful letter to Kimball about that. And Tom shared that with me when he was president of the Federation. And I was inspired by the notion that, that Ding Darling really had a good idea. In fact, I think today he would look at the world and say, there's way too much fragmentation. There's too many groups working on their own, not uniting with one another. He would be using that same quote that a thousand stallions unconnected
right.
cannot move a baby carriage.
Right.
If you look at all the issues that we're working on today, there are 100 different, or in thousands in some cases, different different attitudes and views about what's important, how we're going to approach solutions, but. So I would say that we need to, as a movement, need to come together and reunite the way Darling saw the need for that back in his day. I think it's critical today. And the reason why we haven't solved big problems like climate change and the other wildlife threats are that we need to understand that division is what our opposition wants. They want us to fight over whether it's local or state or federal, or whether it should be cap and trade, or whether it should be cap and packs, or whether it should be some other solution. And that's not getting us where we need to go, and we need to get over that. And
I
think it's really important that we work together and find compromise. And I'm pretty agnostic about the solution, except I want it to be big enough to solve the problem. And I don't have a lock on wisdom on that stuff. And I think it's important that we see our role.
Compromise and common threads. There is so much to me, middle ground and common area that we can agree upon. I just couldn't agree with you more. In terms of your leadership and managing a very vast network of people and locations, does the Federation have a core philosophy or approach in terms of how to best help wildlife survive the challenges of the 21st century? Like climate change and habitat loss, how do you help steer that ship?
Well, we have a strategic plan that was developed in between the staff and the board, and we had other input from our president's advisory council and others and state affiliates as well to forge a vision for the Federation. And that vision is really, there's three prongs to it. The first prong is the notion that we want to keep the wild alive. We want wildlife to survive the changing climate. So it's no longer just helping wildlife have the habitat that they once had, but also making sure that they can transition to a warmer world. And that adds another layer of complication and threat, frankly, to nature. You know, we have cold water fish, we have warm water fish, but we don't have hot water fish. So we need to eliminate the carbon pollution first and foremost. And that is our second leg of this, is that we understand that without carbon controls, we simply are not going to make a world that's safe for wildlife or for our children, which is the third leg. You know, the National Wildlife Federation has been for many, many years and still is deeply committed to the notion that kids need to be outdoors, and that we need to change the course of that, because frankly, too many kids are spending too much time indoors
and on machines.
So those three things
gaming,
are working.
Yeah.
Those three things are the working platform that we build on. Protecting wildlife as the world changes, ending carbon pollution, and reconnecting children to nature.
That's really critical. When you talk about working together and partners needing to be, partnerships needing to be forged, there are probably some likely ones. Who are you working with that it's working, where your voices are joined? Are there any big national players that you'd like to, articulate some successful partnerships? Do any stand out?
Well, I would say that we have a number of partnerships that are working. For example, are part of the Green Group. In my past, I've been chair of the Green Group, which is about 35 major environmental groups. We also work with the hunting and fishing community. We worked very hard, for example, on the passage of the Farm Bill to make sure that conservation compliance was linked to the subsidized insurance program that farmers take advantage of. We work in various critical regions, like in the Great Lakes. The National Wildlife Federation is the driving organization behind the Great Lakes coalition that we call Healing Our Waters. We have a similar coalition in Chesapeake Bay with nearly 100 organizations together working to solve the critical problems of the bay. And we do the same thing in coastal Louisiana with, yet another group of interest, and to try to restore the Mississippi River system so that it actually replenishes wetlands instead of polluting the deep waters of the Gulf. So we have a number of these, collaborations, and I don't want to imply that they aren't there. They are there, and they
right.
are doing well. But what I think is missing right now is that, particularly around climate change, we need to, unite not just to pass or protect state laws, but to really move towards a moment when we can get a price on carbon of some sort, whether it's a cap and trade or whether it's a tax. I don't really care. We just need to price carbon so that we drive clean energy technologies in our environment. And
hurry.
In a hurry, yes, because the science is very – the science is clear. We need to be cutting carbon emissions by at least 5% a year in order to avoid a 2-degree rise in temperature. So we are not anywhere near that. In fact, last year we increased the carbon in the sky from the U.S. by 2%. So we're still far from having what I'd consider appropriate progress.
And those numbers are to stem, not reverse, pretty much. I mean, we need much more rigorous, extreme changes from where I sit to help preserve future generations. I'm sure that you agree with me, but we have to get at least better at what we're trying to do. Well, you talked a little bit. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say just a point on that it's a really important point that you made. The thing about carbon pollution that's different than other pollutants is that you put acid rain in the sky, it eventually falls out and it's gone.
Right.
Or it gets absorbed in the ecosystem. But if you're putting carbon in the sky, you're talking about something that's going to be there literally hundreds, if not thousands, of years. And so we're adding up every day. We're putting on top of what we already put there. So it is a matter of reversing. And I wanted to amplify your point. I think it's important that we see that the longer we delay in action, the bigger the problem is, and we won't be able to reverse it. We're already seeing our weather patterns changing quite dramatically on the planet. If you look at the floods in England, for example, or just the bizarre way in which our system is working these days, it's clear that we're seeing one after another big events that are outside the norm.
And, you know, just living in the Southwest, which we are based in Tucson, Arizona, it's really, really scary. And you'd have to be kind of living in some kind of coma to not understand where you shouldn't have 90 and 95 degree temperatures in January, February, and March. And that's what we're looking at. I mean, it's so clear. And friends in the East are freezing, and ice storms in the South. It's very aberrant conditions. What do you do, Larry, when it comes to your office role? And you have talked about, you know, you have locations all over the country and very much a state-based approach. What is your role, and how do you interface with when it comes to state policymakers? Because a lot of these decisions are made at the state level and sometimes even a county or a municipality. How do you help work on forging sustainable policies to ensure the protection of wildlife and their habitats? Not an easy challenge, I might think.
Yeah, National Wildlife Federation has 47 state and territorial affiliates, and we have a couple of vacancies right now. But we work and really collaborate with our state affiliates, and they take the lead on the state issues. We help in some cases to facilitate some of their actions, and also work in partnership with them on issues. For example, we're working in partnership with our state affiliate in Pennsylvania on fracking. A problem that is growing larger and larger by the day, and it's those kind of things that we try to do and have success. The Pebble Mine in Alaska, for example, our state affiliate is the lead player on that, and we assist them as we may be able to with work in Washington as well as legal help. So those are the two examples I would give, but it's clearly. There's a lot of work to be done at every level, and we need leaders at every level to do that. And that's really why the umbrella nature of the Federation is an important one.
So do you mind if we go off a little bit on fracking?
Sure.
Because to me, it's probably one of the most upsetting shows I ever did. I interviewed Winona Howder from the Environmental Working Group, you know, Food and Water Watch. And
yeah.
I guess where I come from is you read the science about the devastation of fracking on the environment, on wildlife, on our water supply. Why are there a lot of people in the general population that say, yeah, but it's a natural fuel alternative? You know, we're keeping foreign oil from coming into our country. How do I pierce that? I don't really want to choke people. I'm just kind of kidding. But it's like, really, do you understand? And now there are reports here, particularly in the Southwest and around Colorado, where people that were in favor of it, the reports are coming out about the water and people getting really sick and not being able to drink it. And, you know, I didn't make this up. This is science. So what's your, just go off on fracking for me for a minute.
Well, you know, I think there's, and this is one of those areas where even within the community there's a split. You know, there are those who believe that natural gas is a bridge fuel, and I think that it's mostly a bridge to nowhere. It's natural gas is theoretically in a perfect environment about half as much carbon as coal, and that's how they get bought into this notion. Certainly natural gas is cleaner than oil if you're burning it in a bus or something like that. And we all know that. So there's a natural assumption about it. But on the other hand, fracking and frack gas is a little different story. We know that there's leakage going on. In fact, just this past week here in Pittsburgh, where I live, we have a local hospital in Waynesburg that had to be evacuated because the methane levels were so high in the hospital. And they found out that it's coming through the soil, which means it's permeating out of the ground, and they're fracking within a mile of that hospital. And you know, it's a situation where when you inject water under high pressure into these formations, and I'm talking about extraordinarily high pressures,
Yes. You're
going to get some fracturing, and that fracturing, you know, will eventually leak, and it will either leak right away or it'll leak over time.
It's just physics. I mean, it purely, yeah, it has
exactly.
to go, it has to go somewhere. Okay, we have to take a short break. I knew that it would time fly. We're coming up in the end of our first segment. Everybody, when we come back, we're going to talk with more with Larry Schwager, who is the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. And we're going to talk a little bit more about children and the importance of their role in getting engaged with wildlife conservation and preservation. Please stay here with me. Think blue. Think beyond green. Think TDI clean diesel technology. One part of the Volkswagen Think Blue initiative, our goal of creating and encouraging eco-conscious products and behaviors. This is Mrs. Green. A car that can drive a long way should still make you want to, well, drive a long way. Volkswagen Jetta's TDI clean diesel is a high-mileage vehicle that lets you stop at the filling station less often so you can spend more time enjoying the road. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI.
Bookman Sports Exchange is now open at 3330 East Speedway. We're taking our passion and experience of buying, selling, and trading books and music and applying it to the world of sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear. We are giving you another way to save money on the things that you love, Bookman style. Remember, Bookman Sports Exchange, sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear, now open daily from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Speedway east of Country Club. Check out bookmans.com for more info.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And we're certainly being given the opportunity to think about some important issues that affect all of us each and every day. I am so happy to have as my guest Larry Schwager. He is the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation, an organization that is committed to protect wildlife for our children's future. Larry has made climate change a top federation priority and is the author of a book on global warming and wildlife, Last Chance, Preserving Life on Earth. Larry, it's so great to have you here. And we were talking a little bit about one of my favorite subjects, fracking. Do you have any final shout-outs about that before we go on to talking about the children?
Yeah, I think I would like to emphasize the comment I made about it being a bridge to nowhere. You know, there are a lot of, in fact, right here in Pennsylvania, they're building five new gas-fired power plants. And these plants will be around for 50 years. And, you know, there's just no way that we can be burning natural gas for 50 years without having a real problem with the environment, because we're already moving closer and closer to the edge. And even a 50% cut in carbon is not enough, even if they could achieve that, which they can't because of methane leakage. But even if they could do that, it's just simply not enough. And so you're investing in a stranded asset. These are huge and capital intensive projects, and they have a long term payback, and they only make sense if you can operate them for their full life. So I think we're making some really bad investments that will haunt us in the future, will haunt our children.
I think I could not agree with you more, of course. And, you know, it's a little bit off what I wanted to talk to you about, but I know that you can talk about the subject. You know, I was reading last night in the wee hours in the morning, there's a major solar power plant that's going to be opening in California this week. And there's a lot of bird activists, is what I would call them, birders, you know, that are really having a fit about the devastation to the birds. It sometimes becomes such a complex carbohydrate, is the way I say it, because to me, we need to have solar on roofs. We need to be more aggressive about that. There are issues about wind power and bird patterns. I mean, I know there's no silver bullet, but if you ran the zoo, so to speak, what would be your power of choice to protect the animals and to ensure our kids' future? I think it's a really good question to ask of you, because you've had your finger in many pies.
Well, thank you. The 2007 IPCC report detailed, in fact, it drew upon a number of studies that show that we are entering an age of extinction, that we're heading very dramatically into a downturn on the entire planet. And their estimates were that we would lose between, it depends on the temperature range, but, you know, the low end would be about 30% of the species, and the upper end could go as high as 70% of the species on the planet. Well, guess what? We're on that path to go to that upper end because we're putting so much carbon into the sky. So we're talking about 70% of the species in the oceans, in the air, on the land, in the rivers and streams, and that is something that we cannot let happen. And so let's start with that and say, what are the solutions? Well, wind is a solution, solar is a solution, energy efficiency is a solution, and there'll be other solutions as we move in that direction. We worked closely with the wind industry to identify some strategies to avoid bird strikes. There's a lot of new things happening out there. First of all, placement of turbines is really an important first step.
Right.
If you put them in a flyway, you're going to kill birds. If you put them in
a little to the left, it's better.
Yeah, so it's avoiding certain habitats, avoiding places, for example, where ground nesting birds may be threatened by vertical structures. You know, on and on I could go, but nonetheless, we need to place these wind turbines correctly, and there's a sympathy within the industry to do that right. Secondly, they have technology now that's emerging to use radar and laser and other techniques, even underground observers in these wind fields, to monitor the movements, for example, of golden eagles through a wind farm. There is strategies developing how to shut down these turbines when you have a golden eagle moving through, as an example. And so there's a lot of things we can do to minimize and reduce the risk while we're also producing clean energy to produce heading for a carbon-free environment. Same thing is true of solar. You know, these big solar fields that we're going to be developing are being placed in deserts. The last time I checked, deserts one of the ecosystems that's actually growing on the planet because of the warming of the earth. We're seeing desertification occurring across the entire planet. So it's not an at-risk ecological habitat. It is, in fact, a habitat that is growing. So I can tolerate, and there are steps to take to avoid conflicts with desert tortoise and other species that may be affected. But clearly, we need to, you know, take that energy out of those deserts and put it into our power lines. And we need to find a way to make that work by developing smart grids and other techniques to make it more efficient. And so there's a lot to be done. It's not a matter of inventing new technology so much. It is a matter of making a commitment to a clean future.
And, you know, Larry, the thing that I think of when you're talking about it is that we don't really have any choice but to make the burning of our planet the number one priority, because it won't matter about the desert tortoise. And I'm not saying that I don't care. Obviously, I do. And I don't want any bird species to be devastated. But if we don't keep our eye on the big red ball that's burning us up, it's like none of else matters. Let's be aggressive and united in forging the path towards reducing our carbon. I mean, I had a guy, a wonderful man, Jim Beiser, who's a scientist here at the University of Arizona. And he said, you know, people sometimes don't connect greenhouse gas. And what does a greenhouse gas mean? He goes, we live in a greenhouse. And if the greenhouse gets too hot, everything in it burns up and basically dies. And we're in the greenhouse, folks. That's why it's getting a lot hotter. And we can't turn the heat down unless we, you know, hurry up about it. And it's a perfect segue to part of your mission, because my question is a little complex. I'd love for you to talk about how you are connecting kids with nature and the importance of that. And how do you do it? The two-part question is, how do you do it to connect them and yet instill in them the sense of urgency without it being daunting? Does that make sense? It's like, kids, don't be depressed, but really hurry up and get engaged. We're doing this for you.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I think the best way to get kids engaged in the environment is to get them outdoors and to have, particularly with a mentor. I live in the Pine Creek Valley in Pennsylvania, and my home overlooks a stream where Rachel Carson, their mother, would walk as she was a young girl. Her mother would bring her out here, and that's where she developed her sense of wonder. And she, in her book, she beautifully describes the importance of fostering that sense of wonder. You don't have to have all the answers. You don't have to have all the questions. You just need to connect kids with nature. And I think it's important and incumbent upon parents and mentors and people of every stripe to help kids have that connection. I was traveling in a flight between Washington, D.C. and San Francisco, and there was a young boy on the plane, and the pilot came on. It was a beautiful blue sky day. And the pilot said, folks, look out your left-hand window. He said, there's probably the most beautiful view of the Grand Canyon I've ever seen. And I looked over, and this little boy was playing on his game board and never took his eyes off a game board, never looked out that window. And I thought, you know, that's a great tragedy, because we are so enamored with the gadgetry of our world that we miss the things that are really important. And so our efforts have been to get kids in nature in various ways. We have, for example, one of my favorites is the Great American Campout, where families actually set up tents and sleep under the stars. And it's a real, I think, a wonderful way to introduce kids to nature. We have Hike and Seek and another program, Be Out There. So we're trying a number of different things, but we also partner with other organizations to get them engaged in this process, and we provide resources to try to advance that. So we're trying everything we can to, first of all, rekindle that love of nature, but also to help children get exercise and maintain their health. This generation that's sitting in front of screens is really increasingly unhealthy because they're not getting the exercise, they're not getting the outdoor experiences that they desperately need for both mental and physical health.
And, you know, like my grandson, for example, his mom has done an amazing job of doing that, of being in nature. There are no Game Boys allowed at the dinner table, which is where it starts. I mean, really and truly, it starts at the dinner table of conversing and, you know, having conversation and being present. But all I have to do with him is literally go on a walk with him. I don't have to do a curriculum or point things out or get him engaged. If he's outside, he's in an exploration mode. And it's joyous for me to see. So just exposing kids. Mm-hmm. What do you do about, in particular, it's kind of cliche. It's easy for me to say because I can, you know, go see my grandson and I can take him out and my granddaughter and we can do things together. We explore the national forest up in Taos, which is where they live. What about work for inner city kids that don't have an option? Are you doing programs to help kids that might not otherwise have an opportunity to come and experience a tree and a squirrel and a chipmunk?
Well, it's really interesting. We've been working with cities, for example. Atlanta has opened up their parks. They have an ordinance against sleeping in the park. And obviously it's meant to deal with
the homeless population.
So we've gotten a variance from them to do a one-night camp out in one of the several of the local parks there. And that's the kind of thing that we'd like to see across the country. It's hard to transport kids to that pristine
wilderness, right?
Taos. Yeah, the wilderness in Taos. But it's not so hard to just get them out of doors and get them into the local parks. And I think that's a starting point. I would love to take every child in America to special places like you've taken your grandchild, but that's not feasible. And so we're trying to be as realistic as possible and have them at least have some of those experiences of being in nature in a different way.
And I can tell you this. I mean, it puts a big smile on my face. And we're going to talk about this a little bit later in the show. But when I went to New York for 9 days in September, and I'm a Jersey girl, so I know about the city and the country, my daughter and I spent about 8 hours in Central Park and didn't get through it. I mean, you talk about a big piece of nature inside. Yep. There's so much going on there and so many entertainers and mimes and people blowing balloons. It's like that is really a subway ride away for almost any place in the inner city, in New York City. It's right there. And you talk about nature at its finest. I can't believe the things we saw. It was amazing. So you're right.
Well, and I give credit to the Central Park Conservancy for restoring that park. That park was so abused, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
It was scary to go in it.
Exactly. It was a very dangerous place. And they have done a beautiful job of bringing back the original vision and purpose of that park. And they deserve credit. We're working in New York City with a program we call Eco Schools, which is an international program. It's in literally thousands of schools across the planet. And National Wildlife Federation is the primary partner for that. So we're real pleased with what's happening in New York and certainly think the New York schools are really an important player in this overall challenge.
And when you talk about the mentor part, I mean, there are hawks all over New York City. Even in Tucson, we have a myriad of free parks where you can go. We have duck ponds. I mean, just making the time and getting kids out of the house, away from the TV. And, you know, I feel kind of strongly, it's not, a lot of moms say, well, they do get outside, they play soccer. It's not the same as really being present in nature and just being there for that presence. Do you agree with that thing? It's like no, sports is not really the answer. It's a good alternative to being outside and exercise, but we're talking about observing things that occur in nature.
Well, I think there's two things. One, I mean, getting exercise, certainly sports are good for that, for those who are playing the sport. But let's be honest, you know, as it goes along, there are fewer people playing and more watching. And so you have that, you know, that 60,000 spectators and 11 people on a field, you know, or 22 people on a field if you're looking at both teams. But I think the other dimension that's missing is the whole notion of imagination. Our children need to have outdoor experiences to stimulate their imaginations. They are on a nature quest when they're out there, and that experience is really important to grab hold of and to hang on to throughout your life, because we get so boxed in with the way we teach children today that we're really crushing imagination. We're reducing it down to information and not stimulating the imagination as we should be. So I think nature is a key place for doing that. You know, when I was a boy, my brothers and I would build tree shacks, and they weren't the best looking things in the world, but they were ours. And you know, we built dams in little creeks and did all sorts of things. And I look back on that and, you know, realize that we were imagining, we were playing. You know, as we were doing these projects, we had a whole vision for what we wanted to accomplish. So it was you know, 90% imagination.
And if you get kids out there, their imaginations run wild. You should see the fort that my grandson has in Taos, and he collects lumber, and he, you know, yeah. He's got the corners, and nothing makes him happier than for grandma and grandpa to go out and spend some time in his world. I mean, it's so right. And
yep.
You know what else? Let's tie it back to, it does enhance learning. It does get people, children, excited when you tie it in. We have an absolutely outstanding project going on here at Monzo Elementary. And Larry, they have chickens, they have a greenhouse, they have a koi pond, they have aquaponics, and it was a failing school in an at-risk neighborhood. And guess what? I know you're not surprised. Like, all the test scores are going up, attendance is going up, and it's all about that connection with nature and where does your food come from. So we're going to take another break. It always fascinates me when the conversation gets so engaging. I'm getting the signal. When we come back, I'd really like to talk a little bit about the role of women. There's two things, mm-hmm. if we have time to cover. One is the role of women. I met you at the International Women's Earth and Climate Caucus in New York. That's how this show came about. Thank you very much. And what you think that role is emerging into and how important it is. And the other thing I'd like to cover is, given that you are focusing on kids, what's the appropriate role that we can all be engaged in for social media? Because I think that it can be awful for kids to be texting all the time and tweeting and all that, but is there an appropriate role that we have to incorporate because kind of that's where they live? So does that sound like a good closing segment? And then the last part will be anything else you wanted to talk about and a call to action, because a lot of people that are very engaged in Mrs. Green's world say to me, tell me what to do. After I listen to your show, I'd like one thing to be able to go and do. So those are three things we'll cover when we come back, if that sounds good to you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll be right back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. We don't tell you what to think. I'm having the pleasure of interviewing Larry Schweiger. He is the CEO, President and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. Please stay here with us.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Glimmerglass Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green with some pretty impressive news about the VW Jetta TDI. It's got a turbocharged clean diesel engine. It's 90% cleaner than previous diesel engines. It gets 609 miles on one tank of gas, more than the Prius. That's from Tucson, Arizona to San Diego and halfway back. And it's got an amazing 6-speed Tiptronic transmission. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI or visit ChapmanTucson.com.
You already know the Habit Store has cabinets, appliances, and paint, but did you know that we have contemporary and vintage furnishings? You might find a gorgeous new sofa offered at 50% off retail price or an antique mahogany dresser priced to sell. You might also find some great weekly specials on the Red Tag Sale. Keep up with the bargains through Facebook, Twitter, and our monthly newsletter. The Habit Store hours are Monday through Friday 9 to 5, Saturdays 8 to 4, and you'll find us on Grant Road, just off I-10 in Tucson, Arizona.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. This last hour, I have had the pleasure of interviewing Larry Schweiger. He is the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. And in case you don't know what this organization is, how could you not? It's one of America's most effective conservation organizations with 47 affiliates and more than 4 million members and supporters around this world of ours. And, you know, I like to make my show a little different, and it's why people like to listen to me, because I put me in the show. It's not really very flatlined. But I want to say a little bit to embarrass you, Larry, because you are the real deal. You are a visionary. You know, there's your biography, and then there's what I read about what you really do. You say what you think. You have pioneered watershed restoration. You've been promoting ecological research probably for your whole life, when you started in the fort with playing with your brothers and building the pieces of nature that you were wanting to preserve. You're a community leader. You've been on many, many boards, and you certainly are someone that is a champion for this planet of ours. So thank you. I like to always do my personal shout out, not just read from the bio.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate this. Kind words.
Well, I appreciate what you're doing, because God knows we need you, and that is not hyperbole. That is the truth spoken into word. So let's talk about Women's Earth and Climate Caucus in New York. Would you like to talk a little bit about what your experience was there, and then perhaps more broadly, are women stepping up? How important is it that they do in terms of leadership for climate change and a cleaner, healthier planet for future generations?
Well, thank you for that opportunity. I believe very strongly that women are vital for addressing the challenges that we see today. the analogy that I'd give you is that, you know, if you look at it from the biblical standpoint, you know, God sent Adam into the garden, told him to till and to tend. And Adam got so involved in tilling that he forgot about the tending. And we've seen, I think, quite dramatically over recent decades, the tilling has gone so far as to undermine the integrity of all of nature, as well as the future of our great family. So in my view, women need to be a part of the solution, and I would like to see a much more balanced leadership. I was, for example, surprised, but not so, that the women in the Senate came together and forced a compromise on the Congress that was deadlocked on budget. And I think those are the kind of things that happen when you have women in the mix. I'd love to see a lot more of that happening. We certainly need more women in elected offices. And in order to get to that, too, we need to change some of the democratic processes that are broken and intentionally broken to keep control, frankly, in the hands of a few. And so that's sort of a backdrop to my attending the conference. And the conference, I thought, was a good starting point, great conversation from women around the world. I was serving as an advisor to the organization of that gathering for the purpose of helping promote this whole notion of getting women much more involved and engaged in the solution. So I believe Osprey and her friends are going to continue to make a difference. I'm also in communication working with a group called the Founding Family, who understands that the United States is not the democracy that we think it is. It needs some basic things dealt with, and understands that we're in the age of extinction and we need to reverse that. So I think women are going to play a really key role in the years ahead, and I see that movement emerging, and would do anything I could to help foster that type of change.
And the statistics are actually quite impressive in terms of how much of farming is in the hands of women. Purchasing power in the United States, 80% of the decisions for purchases, you talk about power, are made by women. They buy the groceries.
Yep.
You know, Chapman is one of my sponsors. Believe me, they make the decisions about what kind of car the family's going to buy. And that cracks me up, because you think the man does. Well, I spend a lot of time at Chapman. The woman decides. So the power is already there. It's about harnessing it and focusing it. I couldn't agree with you more. And I just want to tell you one little story about the Women's Caucus. I interviewed a woman from Amazon Watch, who I also met in New York, and mm-hmm. she was telling me about the latest activities in Ecuador, where one of the women, Patricia, who was at the caucus, has led basically, you know, we would call it here a march on Washington, but a march on Quito to stop the oil drilling in the area that's going to affect her lands and the tribes around them. So women are gathering as a result of that conference. Seeds were planted, courage was instilled, voices were found. Because you always wonder, you go to some of these things and they really feel good, and there's all these, you know, thought leaders, but what really happens? And when Layla brought it up, it made me very happy. Like, seeds were planted, and there's definitely a movement forward. Okay, let's talk about social media and kids and your organization in general. I mean, it drives people crazy. I think some people are turning away from it, but I believe there is a very important role for getting the message out. What's your spin on that?
Well, you know, I think about what you're doing. For example, you're using all the tools of social media to advance the message that you're working on, and I think that's a great example. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, and I'm using Pinterest and of course email and all the other tools that are at my disposal. I have a blog, and actually a couple blogs, you know, I try to do what I can to get the word out. It's a means of communication. It's not the end
right.
of of it, it's the beginning of it. And I think we need to be using it as a tool. I frankly think our mainline media has failed us. If you look at what's happened, and because there's such a first of all, you turn on the television, instead of having three channels, you have 100. And the quality of programming has deteriorated quite dramatically.
God, it's disgusting.
And we can go off on that. But in addition to that, the distribution of revenue from advertising has also been such that they're much more vulnerable to, because it costs so much to do some of the programming that they do. They have cut corners everywhere. For example, most of our news today is actually not news. It's talking heads.
Right.
Talking
spin.
About what they think is in the news.
It's spin.
Yeah, and it's whether it's left spin or right spin, it's still spin from talking heads. And it's not, you know, camera crews going on. You know, they CNN, for example, I remember one time they dumped something like 60 of their camera crew, got rid of them. Because they aren't using them anymore. They're just, spinning. And I don't mean to single out CNN, because it's true all over. And the other thing that's happened is they're very vulnerable to their advertisers. And so when Big Oil and Big Coal and the other influential players who are part of the incumbent polluting system say don't cover this or don't talk about climate change or don't put that in your weather program, they listen to them and they don't talk about it. So I think we have a real problem. And so for me, the social media is the way around. It's a workaround to the traditional media that we've trusted in the past. So for me, that's what it serves. I think if we get too involved in it, it can be a distraction and keep us from the things that we care about in nature and so forth. But I think it's a very valuable tool.
I think it's intentional. Yeah, it's all about intentional. When people ask me a lot of times, "Did you see this on Facebook? Did you see that on Facebook?" It's noise. It's not intentional. But I look at your website. I look at Food Tank Think Tank. I love this one, and I'm just going to say it. There's a website, a Facebook page, and it's called Give a Shit About Nature. It's one of my favorite, absolutely favorite Facebook pages.
I wish I would have thought of it.
I do, too. And, Larry, it's great. I check it every day. And you talk about important content, and I don't ever say that in my post, but I just say, you know, Give About Nature, because they do, check it out.
Yeah.
The other little rant, I mean, it's just this is really off-grid, but you're so right about media. I called a friend late last night and I said, "Are you tired about hearing about the lane closure in Fort Lee, New Jersey on every national station that you turn on? I'd rather be hearing about how many kids were abducted for sex trafficking in New York City or how many kids went to bed hungry. I understand the bigger picture. I know why they're going after Chris Christie. But really, folks, can we cover something on the news that matters?
There's my little
rant, okay?
Yeah. If you go on international news, for example, BBC or the French TV, I was in New York City last week and had a chance because their cable carries some of that. And the quality of their news is so much better than ours. It's unbelievable. First of all, they have international news as well as national news, and we don't do international unless there's something really outrageous going on. But they cover the international conversations that are going on by our governments. They cover things that are really important and impactful to our world that we don't hear about here in the U.S. In fact, when I was at the Copenhagen conference on climate, CNN had two separate channels, one for U.S. and one for the Europeans. And the European CNN channel covered the details of the conference and were drilling into what was being discussed, who was saying it, that sort of thing. The U.S. channel was talking about ClimateGate, which is nothing more than a fabrication by the polluters. And the whole time this was going on, you see this stark difference between CNN International and CNN U.S. It was really stunning to me to watch that. And so we're being fed information that, frankly, is quite filtered, and we need to be very careful about that because our world depends on getting the right information.
But we have to really be important in our watching of TV and make sure we follow things like The Real Housewives of New Jersey and The Kardashians. I mean, it's like, come on, people. You should hear my husband go on quite a rant. And one of my daughters sends me things all the time, the different covers of Time magazine. I mean, they put different covers on it. It's just a whole very dumbing down of America that saddens me. So we have about... You know, we don't have that long a time left. I'd like you to answer two things, if you will. One is, in the seat that you have, which is a powerful seat, it's an important seat, it helps affect policy, it helps forge policy and really make a difference with your team of people. What's the biggest challenge you feel you're facing sitting in that seat right now for the next, you know, if we have 10 years, sometimes I wonder if we have 10 years, but right now, what are you looking at that you want to share with everybody as one of your biggest challenges?
Well, I think from an institutional standpoint, the challenge we have is because we are a middle America organization, many of our members don't have the resources that they used to have. And
right.
And our traditional way of communicating through the mailbox, for example, isn't performing as well as it should, and is a real challenge. So I think those are challenges from an operational standpoint. But beyond that, in terms of the movement itself, we need more and more Americans to understand that climate change is not a political issue. It's a moral issue. It's an issue of the future of our children. And I don't know a single person who would intentionally jeopardize their child or their grandchildren's future, and yet that's what we're doing collectively. We need to understand that we have a moral obligation to end this carbon pollution so we protect the world as our parents and grandparents have done for us. So I think it's really important that we get across to the average American that this is a critical moment in life on Earth. And we need to act responsibly.
It's just like eloquent. I got goosebumps, and I'm not kidding. I wish I could just, take that clip and put it out. But we'll be pulling that out for our tweeting about it when we tweet about the show being aired. And the other piece is that I think is significant, and we're finding that even in the nonprofits that I work with, it's engaging the younger generation so that they become a funding base or an engaged consumer supporting your work. A lot of the young kids in organizations that we have, we look around and we're all, even in Rotary, you know, it's not great that the average age in Rotary is 60. So we're putting a big focus on recruiting, you know, kids under 40, anybody under 40 to me is a kid, mm-hmm. under 40, under 30, and successfully engaging them and making it fun and exciting. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And we never even talked about your website, which I think we should. I looked at it so many times. It's nationalwildlifefederation.org.
It's at NWF.org.
NWF.org.
Yeah, you can find us, and I would tell you too. All of our blogs and links to my writings and all sorts of things are there as well as the programs that we talked about, getting kids in nature and our efforts to help wildlife survive a warming world, and the work we're doing on climate change.
It's
all that
a wonderful
can be found,
website
on our site.
Yeah, it's inviting, engaging, it's easy to navigate. Your Twitter handle is at NWF, I saw that. And the other thing I want to bring, what a note to end on, Ranger Rick. You still have Ranger Rick magazine. I mean, it was like when I saw that on one of your pages, I'm like, oh my gosh, you've got to be kidding. What a delightful
discovery. Well, Ranger Rick is
discovery.
An app now, and I would He's an app
he's
as well
app.
As a magazine. So you can get Ranger Rick's Treehouse and other Ranger Rick apps and some fun games if you just go online and download the app. So that's the other way to engage kids.
Absolutely. Get them to go to the Kids in Nature page at NWF.org. So, Larry, thank you so much. I am very glad that you took the time. I'm appreciative that our paths crossed way back when, and was it September, I think? Yeah.
Yep.
So it is. And thanks for the work you're doing, and I hope that our paths cross again. Everybody.
Thank you.
On this same trip, I just want to talk about the show for next week. I went to a national Go Green conference, and I met Marcy Zaroff, another area that we need to focus on. She's the founder of Portico Grand Group, and we'll be talking about what I call the filthy fashion industry, its human capital, and we'll be talking to Marcy, who is a global leader for sustainable fashion. Everybody, make it a great green week. Larry, again, thanks for what you do. Thanks for all of the work of the National Wildlife Federation. And again, I hope our paths continue to cross and that you'll promote the show because it was a great one. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay. Take good care.
Bye.
Make it a green week.